So let's just take one more minute to allow everyone to come in. Even when we practice each day at home, just to take a few moments to allow your body and mind to settle onto the cushion is very, very important. In the Mahamudra tradition, in sometimes it's referred to as untying the knots, just really loosening, just really softening, just being present. And then always, let's just take a moment to appreciate the fact that we share this extraordinary tradition, this tradition that is so beautiful and so profound and so rare, and how fortunate we are that it has survived all of these centuries and now we're the recipients. It's extraordinary. Tolkien used to say that even in his generation, the teachings on nature of mind were so secret that there was a silver tube, a particular silver pipe that was designed so the teacher could whisper to the ears of the student and so that no one else could hear. This is how special it is. And appreciate the fact that we are like-minded friends. We can gather like this as friends along the path. Of course, being on Zoom is somewhat different, but it allows us to do this. How lucky we are. Okay, so as always, I'm going to rattle on about a couple of things for a little bit, and then let's open it up. We don't have a huge group today, so we have plenty of time to talk about whatever you'd like to talk about. But I'm in the sort of enviable position of being able to sort of just ruminate about nature of mind and the path and the Dharma altogether for days and days and days, and then I have somebody to share it with, and that's you. So for me, I think, and as I say all the time, it doesn't really matter which piece or what it is that excites us, that inspires us. The beauty of the Dharma is that any one thing has the power to basically open up everything else. If all we can remember is don't cause harm, the entire Dharma path, from the beginning to the end, the three jhanas are all there. So for me today, what I've been thinking about is this question about what I think is, maybe the most important question, which is actually how we take our nature of mind training into our world. And this is what we call Lamkhier. Lamkhier means how to apply what we've learned in our life. So, as you know, we always go on and on and on about mindfulness and awareness. And Mingyur Rinpoche pretty much always uses the terminology of awareness. Although the word that we're using, mind for mindfulness and awareness, are the same word. So I wanted to just chat a little bit about how these dance together. So in talking to Tolkien about this question, I remember him once saying, I asked him, what is the relationship between mindfulness and awareness? And he said, awareness is like the light, and mindfulness is like narrowing that light or shining that light on whatever we choose to shine it on. It's the same light, but here with mindfulness, we're actually applying it. So you could say that in some ways, mindfulness is the focus or the application of awareness. And awareness itself, you might say, is the whole field that it comes from. So in the nature of mind tradition, you'll often read things like, keep mindfulness on guard. So what are we guarding here as nature of mind practitioners? Because when we hear about nature of mind, and we hear about resting in ease and resting beyond effort and beyond hope and fear and beyond activity. So what does it mean to keep mindfulness, keep ourselves on guard? So we're always working with in two dimensions. We're working with a conceptual dimension, and then we're working with a non-conceptual dimension. Roughly, you could say that anytime we work with concepts, and those concepts could be the four boundless attitudes, they could be paramita practices. Anytime we're working with concepts, what we're doing here is we're generating merit. Anytime we're going beyond concepts, this is the generation of wisdom. So all Vajrayana traditions agree that the path is the accumulation of merit and wisdom. So we're doing both. But in mindfulness here, what we're doing is we're bringing a kind of careful discernment into cause and effect of how is it, what is it that we do, and what is the effect of what we do? Why are we doing it? How are we doing it? What's going on? To be vigilant, to be discerning about how we handle our body, speech, and mind. This is the outer training of a nature of mind practitioner. So basically, this is called conduct of observing cause and effect. When I speak like this, this happens. When I do this, this happens. We never go beyond that. We never go beyond taking extreme care in how we deport ourselves in the world. The classic comment on this comes from Guru Padmasambhava. All of you have heard it, but it's a sort of foundational comment, which is, he said, my view is as vast as space, but my activity is as fine as barley flour. So the injunction is to never go beyond that. Never forget our activity. For a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is if we do cause trouble or disturbance with our body, speech, and mind, that has the effect of clouding our access to the nature of mind, because that creates patterning. So then awareness again is sort of the general field, the background. Awareness holds the mindfulness. So when we rest in awareness, there is a quality of sort of expansive openness. This is what we call unimpededness, zangtal in Tibetan. In other words, experience completely beyond grasping, open, free. This is the mind of a yogin. This is the mind of a nature of mind practitioner. And as nature of mind practitioners, our guiding principle is the view of our own basic nature, our own abiding wisdom, our indestructible wisdom, our Buddha nature, our primordial purity. There's, as you know, there's so many names for this basis.
What?
So this is the view. So as nature of mind practitioners, we have complete faith in that, complete trust in that. And with that, everything.
Oh, I thought this was the way we were going.
Oh, everybody remember to mute.
Could be.
So with that confidence, it comes deeper realization.
Sure. It is.
Greater
it
openness. Is. Hold on, I'm going to try to mute everybody. So
that way goes to the fox.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So we know what this was like last time. Let's make sure.
Let's everybody remember to mute.
Maybe it's going to be a little better. I don't know.
Okay, hold on a sec. Let's see. Okay. So this openness, this nature of mind itself, this from this comes spontaneously and naturally and authentically this quality of connection with the world, this quality of care for the world.
Oh, okay.
Hold on.
Yeah, let's go up to Fox.
How do I mute all?
Yeah.
I mean, it has really kind of turned it down. But we still have all the fun.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, but
hey,
I don't need to do...
Zoom. Yeah. Genius is up there. How do I mute all?
Under participants. Yeah.
If you under participants.
And it will show you the mute all. You're the host.
Mike. Back.
Alternatively, yeah. Tim,
Tam, just ask her.
Yeah, that's what Patricia? I would suggest.
Just ask her.
Janice?
It's Patricia, I think.
Okay, let's mute. Okay. All right, let's do the best we can here. So again, this quality of the nature of mind itself, the field that we're talking about, when we're working with concepts, that we're applying that to our bodhisattva intent. Again, working with the four boundless attitudes, the paramitas or whatever. But when rest in its own place, the expression of this openness, the expression of nature of mind is itself spontaneous, profound, completely authentic compassion. Compassion is the energy, is the activity of this openness of mind. I remember, maybe some of you have heard me mention that I was asking Tolkujan about this. We were talking about these things. And I said, he never talked about generating the four thoughts or, you know, generating compassion or practicing compassion. He never talked about that ever. And I said, Rinpoche, why don't you talk about compassion and devotion like a normal lama? And immediately he said, having compassion where tears are flowing from your eyes and devotion where the hair on the back of your neck is standing up. He said, who has that anyway? So he wasn't saying don't have it. What he was saying is allow it to be completely authentic. Allow it to be an expression of our practice of nature of mind. Then it becomes non-conceptual. It's the natural, spontaneous response to the world. This compassionate experience is like if the background of awareness is completely open. In that openness, the atmosphere of that openness is the warmth of love and compassion. So this is not something that we have to create. It's already baked into the system. This is the nature, very nature of who we are. So then in terms of how we work with this during the day, as you know, we've all had pointing out instructions. So pointing out instructions is sort of like the lama, you know, opens the curtains and says, okay, here's what's behind the curtains. And it's always been there. And we go, wow. And then because of habit and karma, those curtains close again. And so our practice is to keep opening the curtains. Short times, repeated many times. Open, wow, I'm going to be like this for the rest of my life. And this is the way it goes. So this openness, of course, on the cushion, what we do basically is we give ourselves pointing out and then rest there. We get distracted. We come back again. This is what this the cushion practice. The day-to-day practice is to access this openness anytime, any place, however we can. And the world lends a hand. The world gives us infinite numbers of ways to open. So at moments, just spontaneously, at moments of course, of great compassion and great devotion, the openness is there. This is the beauty of love. This is the beauty of compassion. is we're completely open. And that's the openness of nature of mind. It's there when we're shocked. There's a moment of openness. The curtains open and we have access to mind's authentic mind's nature at the moment of falling asleep. When we just take a pause, we're just take a deep breath, we're right there. In situations of great beauty, it's so wonderful. As you, many of you know, that in the Celtic tradition, they talk about thin places, going to places where just there seems to be no barrier between one's own sort of funky way of being and the proverbial divine, whatever it might be. So for us, the practice is always to come back to this. Again, it's always available to us. These moments of openness, however we find
them. Right, it goes forever. Okay.
These are the curtains opening up, and we're right there. We're exactly right.
Okay.
The image, as you know, is, as you've heard so many times, is like a child in a cathedral. Just open. Not a lot of concepts, not a lot of questioning, not a lot of self-reflection. It's like, wow, amazing. This is the example. And when we train in this quality of openness and relaxation again and again, what develops over time is a sense of ease, a sort of balance, a natural warmth, an authentic warmth, a sort of good-heartedness, a trust in oneself. Even, as we've said, the rarest of all human experiences, which is a little bit of sense of humor about who we are. So again, to sort of wrap up, the main point always in the way we carry the nature of mind through the day is to use it to allow us to soften and open. It's all about openness. As Tolkugin said, the difference between Buddhas and sentient beings is like the difference between the narrowness and openness of space. Sentient beings are like the space held within a tightly closed fist, while Buddhas are fully open, all-encompassing. This is the practice. It's the difference between the narrowness and openness of space. As he always said, this is samsara, this is nirvana. It's as simple as that. So through the day, we take any and every opportunity, even strong negative emotions, have the ability to crack us open into the space of the nature of mind. And so then within that openness, we carry that through the day. We carry that just general. So this is what Mingyur Rinpoche refers to as vertical liberation. When there's a kind of gap that we all know about so well, this is what he refers to as horizontal liberation. Thought, 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 boop, no thought. Thought, thought, thought. This is classically, when people get pointing out, this is what we're going for. But as a practitioner throughout the day, there's this quality, what Mingyur Rinpoche calls, for whatever reason, or vertical liberation, which is just there's a natural sense of presence, of awareness, of openness. As he says, it's like walking along the edge of the river without being carried away in the river. And when asked, Tolkugin said it this way. He said, no matter what you do, no matter what situation you're in, whether walking, sitting, eating, or lying down, always suspend your attention within the nature of non-dual awareness. That's it. So that just simply means we bring this quality of openness, this quality of awareness, very lightly to any situation, that there's a sense. It's like, again, it's like the temperature in the air or the humidity in the air. There's just a sense of the presence of knowingness, of awareness, of openness. That's the practice of nature of mind on a day-to-day basis. Okay, so let's leave it at that and open it up. Ellie.
Thanks, Tim. I just sort of want to share with you what crossed my mind as you were talking. You know, where I get tortured by my ego is looking at this idea that I have all these choices, and am I going to make the right choice? And is it going to be coming from the negative karma patterns I have or not? And how do I know that? And what do I do in terms of making these choices? And am I following the paramitas? And I can go on and on about that. But I think what I just heard you say is that in and of itself is the tightness. And that I need to somehow let that go and open up the curtain, that dilemma, that tortured kind of ego discussion inside of me is the tightness that I need to be aware of and try to let go of. Is that true? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I don't know. Yes. I mean, if we're tight, if we can feel that we're tight, we work to let that go. But being conscientious about who you are and what you are and what you say and do in the world, even if we're a little uptight about it, this is a good kind of grasping. This is wholesome grasping. So we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, if that makes sense. So that active aspect of mind, so this is what we're doing. We're training that active aspect of mind to, as Trungpa Rinpoche used to say, grow up and be a good citizen. So we're doing both at the same time, if that makes sense. We have to train in all situations. So in all fairness, there's only a very small sliver of the day in which we're actually resting in nature of mind. And the rest, then we're contending with our thoughts and emotions. And in that regard, we take our mindfulness to guide ourselves in a way that is wholesome. That's what we do there. It's so critical because it's very easy in the West when, you know, when magazines and books are written and the question is, well, shall I talk about nature of mind or should we talk about paramitas? Nature of mind will sell more copies all the time. But we never get beyond the conceptual practices of compassion, of the paramitas. And to think that we ever do is just a wrong understanding as a nature of mind practitioner. Yeah. Not that you have a misunderstanding, but it needs to be said.
Okay. Is there a way to sort of reassure myself around the notion of this idea that I could be, even though my intention is there, that in my own ignorance or my own tendency to fool myself, that I could make a really bad choice that, and maybe I just need to live with that. I'm not sure how to make peace with that, along with the idea that I'm opening the curtain, my tension is, and for the moment, I'm going to try and just do the best I can.
Ellie, how long have you been practicing for?
I've been with Tiergar for 5 years.
And before that?
Before that, I was doing Zen for about 8 years, but I never really connected to it. It was really a struggle for me. I really didn't get grounded until I found Tiergar.
Well, I think one of the things they never tell you about is that our patterning doesn't really stop. It just loosens up. And then as it loosens up, it just somehow naturally, we can taste there's some wisdom to it. But this takes time. So I've been a daily meditator for 50 years. I'm still expecting it's going to happen one of these days.
Okay.
So I think the point is just enjoy the path.
That I can do. I can
and
work
just,
on that.
And just do the method. So as you've heard me say before, again, when asked about these kinds of things, Tokujin said, and this we can take to the bank. He said, just taking 7 steps towards your cushion with the intention to tame your mind and open your heart for the benefit of yourself and others. That makes this life meaningful, is what he said. And then he said, just get on the cushion, do your practice. More than that, he said, when you get off the cushion, just leave it. So aspiration, that we have some control over. Just work with that and then do the method. Nature mind practice is a method. And when it's, and it just has a natural cause and effect like any method. And when we come back again and again and again, eventually the coming to get back becomes effortless. But this takes time, needless to say. Sue Ellen.
Yes, I have unmuted myself. Good. And just bringing it around to the current situation with the couple who finally did mute themselves. If people don't, I mean, so we were compassionate. We waited for them to figure it out and then stop. But say this was a more intense conversation or something, then would it be inappropriate to just boot them out? Or is that considered non-compassionate? I mean, is it really?
I would never boot out anybody, Anna.
I know you wouldn't, but
conversation. So I don't think it's appropriate. People make innocent mistakes.
Yeah, I know. But it did go on for some time. People
That's
emailed
okay.
her.
That's okay. It's good for us. It's good training for us.
Okay, that's a good way to look at it in an appropriate sort of manner. But I know that Zoom is not an easy platform and that things change, but I think some people are fairly lackadaisical on just learning to cope with it. I'm currently learning how to cope with the cell phone, and I hate it, and I feel imposed upon immensely. But, you know, I'm a human being, and that's what they do these days. So it's the kind of a responsibility and that we do need to take. So then where is there like a transition between responsibility and, which is really being compassionate to everyone as well.
Responsibility is for us. The responsibility is for us to work with whatever happens. So we can use the beautiful and very, very famous example from Shantideva that we could, if our feet hurt, when we're walking on the ground, we could try to cover the entire globe with leather, or we could cover our own feet. And when we cover our own feet, everything works out. This is classically the teachings in patience, but this never changes. So these minor irritants of the world become our teachers, our really good teachers, actually. This is what we call the guru of the phenomenal world. When we claim to be practitioners, the world rises up and just throws everything at us to strengthen our practice or to show us where we're lacking. So I take this as good news. Yeah, good, Sue Ellen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Someone else had their hands raised a second ago. Bertie?
Yeah, this is kind of simple. It seems like to me, in light of some of what we're talking about, we can practice the six parameters, and that's voluntary. It sounds like from what you're saying part of the time is that compassion is really involuntary. It's something that just comes. Is that?
Yeah. Actually, now that I think, I might not even have finished that story about Tolkien talking about tears flowing from your eyes. The point is that the authentic expression is coming from the openness of nature of mind.
Yeah.
When that's not present, then we train in it somewhat artificially.
Mm-hmm.
When we're, practicing compassion, thinking about compassion, repeating the verses of the four boundless attitudes, yeah, whatever. This is a little bit artificial. But we do
and
it anyway.
It's voluntary. It's voluntary, and it's good
that's
that
right.
We do it. But
it's intentional.
Any compassion is involuntary. Yeah.
And then that ripens into what we call non-referential compassion, and then we talk so beautifully like compassion, like the sun shines, just mm-hmm. on everyone with no intention, with no discrimination.
Yeah.
It's just the energetic display of nature of mind. It's so beautiful. If compassion, and compassion, by the way, is the marker of nature of mind. It's the marker of our practice. This is why great lamas go on and on and on and on about it. It's the cause of our practice, because we have compassion for ourselves and we're suffering. So it's the reason we practice. It's the practice itself. And it's the marker of the success of practice. If ever we want to know how our practices are going, just notice what we see and think and feel when we look out into the world and look out at other people. It's really, it's so simple, actually. Yeah. Lisa. You are muted. Still muted. Lisa, you know this. Bottom, there we go.
I know. I'm working with our patience here, Tim. I'm seeing. and I was writing notes, and my notes are more important than talking. No, I'm teasing. So the question, this, okay, a little bit of a side. Court was talking yesterday about the two types of wisdom, the innate wisdom and the acquired wisdom. Okay. And he says that for most of us, we start with this acquiring wisdom, getting to know our Buddha nature. It starts as a seed and it begins to grow. And then over time, we start to see, yes, indeed, this is who I am. So, I'd like to do more of this acquired wisdom, because for whatever wonky reason, I just decided I was going to have complete faith and trust in the guru and the teachings. And so now I need to kind of reverse that and develop some good understanding of this. More, it's a little bit hard to ask, you know, how can I now start gaining some actual, putting some concepts on what I feel in my heart? How do I say to myself, yes, this, do you understand what I'm saying, Tim? Is this completely wrong?
Well, the concepts, well, go ahead. Well, you were saying, what do I feel in my heart? Say more about that.
Oh, the if we have this innate wisdom, we know I'm on this path. This is who I am. But yet we learn that there's certain applications that we should use when I'm getting angry, or I should do some of the Abhidharma teachings that we've learned as an antidote. If I'm getting sleepy, there mm-hmm. are antidotes, mm-hmm. Which do put us in that really a little bit of a tighter framework, mm-hmm. but it does allow us to get through the situation and to develop wisdom in a different way. So I guess that's kind of what I'm hoping to explore.
You know, often what we can say that there's two kinds of wisdom. There's two kinds of Vipassana practice.
Okay.
There's compassionate Vipassana practice using concepts, which is analysis. Where is my mind? What color is it? Where do these thoughts come from? And then by extension, sort of anything we use with concepts. And then there's resting Vipassana, which is resting in the nature of mind. And we're always going to be using both. Because we need to train our concepts, because our concepts are old and funky. So we train our concepts. This is why we talk about the view that all beings are perfectly pure. This is the ultimate antidote to every problem, which is the view of bringing the view. And we remind ourselves, we get irritated at somebody, and then we remember, oh, they're a perfect bodhisattva, but because of their own obscurations, they don't see it. And because of my obscurations, I don't see it in them. This is the way a nature of mind practitioner talks to themselves, or we should be talking to ourselves all the time. Yeah.
Okay. So I think what you're saying here, just to be clear, is just to get this inner dialogue going a little bit more. Don't just rest in nature of mind, but just ramp up the
discussion. Oh, absolutely. No question about it. No question. Okay. Because our resting in nature of mind practice is not strong enough to cut through the solidification of, you know, funky neurotic projections.
Okay. And as I've been starting to do this, so I'm going to spend a little bit more time, I'm noticing what Rinpoche talks about, that the poop on the wall starts to become a little bit smellier. So I'm noticing my neurosis a bit more. It's become like, who the heck? Like, I'm a pissed off person. I'm pretty angry most of the time.
So that's insight.
Good.
The beautiful thing is when we realize, so this is the way it goes. So I'm not picking on you, Lisa, but if you realize, oh, I'm a pissed off person most of the time, what we're doing is we're relieving, we're lifting from the world our projection of pissed offness. We have just benefited the entire world. Now we're beginning to own our own pissed offness. And now this is, now we have a chance to really work with it. We can't work with it if it's all over the world. So this is how we change our perception. As Manjari Mate says, the entire path is a change of perception. When we begin to recognize our own patterning, that is the open door to freedom. That's the beginning of real freedom. Until then, we're trying to manipulate the world and get other people to do, to sort of march to our own weird drummer, basically. Yeah. Good. Okay.
Thank good. You so much.
This is good news. When we recognize just how crazy we are, this is considered good news. Really, literally, this is good news.
Okay, good, good. Thank you.
Brooke and or Doug?
It's my turn.
Brooke?
Hi, so nice to see you. We lost you. So, but finally I found you again. So happy.
I feel the same way.
On it goes. You said so many things today that I could take to the bank. But I was thinking back to the 3 days we did on Lojong, and you said something that's been a constant conversation between us, which is the story you told about drunk on afflictions.
Yeah.
I mean, that has spoken so deeply, like as a lens. And I wonder if maybe you could reflect a little bit more. I don't think I remembered the story perfectly. But
well, I'll mention the story really quickly. You know, when I was coming through, like all of us, I was obsessed with this question about compassion. I just knew there was something in there that was going to be liberating them. So I was going to all of my teachers just to basically ask them that question, very sort of naive way. So Trungpa Rinpoche lived a couple of stone's throws away. And so in those days, as you can imagine, there was no cell phones or anything. And so there was no way to call ahead. So I just basically walked into his bedroom, which is about the size of my office. And he was such a lovely person that anybody who came in front of him got his full attention. He was so special. So I said to him my classic question, which is, okay, I don't get it. Why is this compassion thing so important? And he said, well, if you were sitting in your office and someone came into your office and upended your desk and your papers went flying, what would you do? And I said, well, of course, I'd be furious. And he said, but if a friend of yours walked into the office and you could tell that they were drunk and they fell over and they hit your desk and your papers went flying, what would you do? And I said, well, I'd get up and see if my friend was okay. And he said, everybody is drunk on their afflictive emotions. And I said, okay, got it. So that's the way we need to understand the world. We need to understand that everybody is drunk on their own afflictive emotions, which means their own patterning, their karmic patterning and conditioning. And because we're drunk on our afflictive emotions, we don't see that. We don't see ours clearly. We don't see the world clearly. So this is what we have to understand. And if we understand that we're all confused, we're all perfect beings who are confused, there's no other response to that but kindness and compassion.
Yeah, thank you, Amir.
That's a path in and of it. This is the path. This is the path of pure perception. This is the path that we're on, actually. This is the fruition of the Vajrayana path, which is pure perception, which is no great, all we're beginning to do is see the world and beings as they are, not as a projection of our neurosis. It's as simple as that, actually. It's quite simple. Yeah. Does that make sense, Brooke?
Makes total sense. And it's so helpful. Sometimes there's just the languaging that captures something that, you know, you just, you see it so much more clearly. I think sometimes what I find these days is almost like a beginner's thing, but, you know, like that thing about you can't, you put leather on your own shoes, not leather on the world. That's a wonderful image.
Yeah.
But our temptation is always to put leather on the world to fix the outer conditions. And I find it so hard with others, and I'm still a therapist, you know, sometimes it's like, no, it's like it's internal. And it's a very hard switch for people to make of viewing that it's my own behavior and my own perception that's creating in a deep way. I'm not talking, obviously outer things happen. There are external conditions, they impact us. I would never take that away. I think that's essential. But people blame so much the outer condition and they can't see their internal relationship.
I think it's getting worse and worse and worse.
No, and it's
I think the culture of blame and solidifying is becoming worse at the speed of light. It's really frightening, actually. This is
what I'm talking about. Thank you.
This is why this is so important right now. Yeah. Brenda.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you. Yeah. I was confused suddenly with an interaction maybe two or three participants ago, because I think what I heard was that compassion is spontaneously uprising and exists in our experience of the world. And as a Buddhist psychology psychotherapist, my experience is that it is surely inborn. I always begin in my conceptualization of my clients in their infancy with their past lives and their karma buoying them to whatever may come. By the time they meet me, compassion needs at least to be awakened. I do think of it as taught.
Yes. So we do it both ways.
Okay.
The fact that they come to see you at all, that's their innate compassion.
Yeah.
So then that has to be worked with both conceptually and non-conceptually. So in our tradition, in many traditions, that we work on it, you know, may all beings be happy in their fruit, on and 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 on. And then something opens up. In the nature of mind tradition, there's a kind of one-pointed faith in the nature of mind, assuming that we're great practitioners. So for us, in our tradition, we come at it in both ways. We come at it working with concepts and non-conceptually, and we come at it however we can. So the working with concepts would involve also going to a therapist, for instance, to get help, you know, at seeing and changing. Yeah, it's beautiful. So we use both sides.
And on a practical level, the engagement for me in the world with the tailgater, or for me in the world with the thing that's too expensive, is the condition from which compassion is the vehicle for liberation. When I'm with a client who's not practicing, not studying the Dharma, they are the condition for me to experience the liberation of compassion. And I know that they have that precious human birth attribute as well. Correct? Not correct.
Completely correct.
Oh, goody.
If they didn't, they wouldn't be in front of you. There'd be no helping them anyway. This is all we're doing as therapists is helping people in any one of a million ways to reconnect with who they already are. But our ability as a therapist or as a friend or just as someone on the street, our ability to look and see their perfect nature, to be witnessed in that way, that is transformative. That alone is transformative. Yeah. That's why therapy, when it's when it's called for is so fabulous because it's a chance to be, everybody needs to be known, to be heard, to be seen, to be acknowledged, as you know. And why? Because they care about themselves. That's their basic goodness. That's their basic nature. And so as therapists, in any one of a million ways, we nurture that flame of their own kindness. It's beautiful. Great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jemmy.
Hi. Hey. Sonia Rinpoche has said that overcare is the big problem that he sees. Have you heard that before? I think about that and I think,
what does he mean by overcare? In what way?
Just being too open-hearted is my sense. Too sensitive, I guess, too open-hearted. And I wonder, you know, as practicing to develop compassion, it seems like what would the antidote to overcare be? Like not caring? Do you
wisdom. Wisdom.
Can you say
so
more?
Until there's wisdom, so this, as we always say, compassion and wisdom, the two wings of the bird. And without wisdom, all we have is that impulse to help. But wisdom gives us the space, the perspective, the understanding of oneself, understanding of the situation. Wisdom takes us beyond boxes of there's me caring for you. As long as this conceptualization, there's going to be some kind of burnout because our care is self-referenced, not self-referenced. I don't mean such a bad way, yeah. But there's always me in it. So this is why we continue to work with wisdom and the practice itself. So at some point, it just all opens up, just like the sun. The sun never gets burned out because the sun just shines. The sun shines on anybody, friend, enemy, near, far. There's not all of this planning, this, you know what I mean? Me as a good person. The sun never thinks, oh, I'm a good sun, so I'm going to shine on these people, but those people I don't really care yet about. So this is where we're going.
Yeah, I guess
I think what Sonia Rinpoche is talking about is this sort of, how could we say, this kind of self-conscious compassion.
I guess that, I mean, sometimes I don't think of what I'm feeling as self-conscious. It's just kind of just really, really strong, overwhelming feeling of heart for something, but not being able to fix the situation still, you know.
That's okay. That's called the genuine heart of sadness.
And yet, like, okay, so I take care of hospice dogs, and I used to think if I didn't keep them, their suffering in mind constantly, I wasn't doing the right thing or wasn't there for them. So I kind of,
well, that's just a concept.
Yeah. And so
this we let go and see what's left and see what's left.
Yeah. It's a weird feeling of like, stop caring so much, but it's that conceptual way of caring, I guess.
That's right. Where do you live, Jemmy?
Colorado Springs.
Oh. This was suspicious of like a California question, so I had to check it out.
Okay.
Yeah, I think you get the point. So this is where we can always go. And this is where we go. We find that our compassion is more spontaneous and less of a project. Yeah. This is a therapist problem. When we become self-identified as the helper.
Or just like a sensitive, hypersensitive person kind of problem, right?
I mean, could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
Like the feeling of yeah, I mean, you said earlier, like we have our patterns that are always kind of there, no matter how long we've practiced, we have that familiar field or whatever. And I think that's my kind of thing, is being overcaring and that.
Yeah, but you know, this is a good problem to have.
Yeah, yeah.
But
nevertheless, it takes wisdom, right? I mean,
it does take wisdom.
Yeah.
And it takes decompressing. It takes continuing to practice, continuing to take care of ourselves, taking walks, opening up, enjoying ourselves, not bearing down on the project of saving all beings. That will burn us out, needless to say. Yeah. You're a hospice person for animals?
Yeah, for dogs.
Oh my God. I had to take my darling puppy to the dentist 3 days ago. He had two molars taken out. It was the worst day of my life, much less being a hospice person for dogs. Yeah. Oh. So what else? We have a couple minutes. This, this is what we should be wondering about, is working with our nature of mind practice, working with our paramita practice, how they inform each other, how they direct each other, how they bleed into each other. This is why in the paramitas, for instance, all the activities are conceptual of generosity and right conduct and patience and exertion. These are conceptual. The six is wisdom, that's non-conceptual, and meditation is the bridge. So we work with concepts until we arrive at wisdom, and then wisdom informs all of what we do. Hence, it becomes a paramita, a transcendent activity. We're transcending our own designs, our own plans. So these work together. In some texts, for instance, the 7 points of mind training, the wisdom piece is right at the beginning. And then everything that comes after that, all the conceptual pieces, are informed with what we are pointed out to in the beginning. So this is the 7 points of mind training. So depending on which tradition we're talking about and who's teaching and writing, we'll either start with wisdom and it comes from wisdom, or we'll start with concepts. And then we look for the wisdom as a consequence of that, with the idea that discovery of wisdom is the moist ground for the discovery of the nature of mind, or wisdom in this case, is the moist ground of merit. So this, we can always, in any text we read, we'll always be working with both of these. Yeah. What else? Anyone? Harriet? You are muted.
Okay.
There we go. You want to put your camera on?
I'd rather not.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. in regards to the sensitivity, I've been practicing for quite a long time. And it feels like, I have definitely the feeling of when compassion flows and I am not there. But it seems lately that the ego, I don't know if it is ego, like everything lingers longer. Like I write a text and then it lingers. And so it's harder to let go, I guess. But my image is, I know openness, total openness. So then just things flow and nothing sticks. So now it feels like it sticks longer. And as if there is, I feel more ego.
What sticks?
When I write a text, the text sticks. Like it's like I am in it still.
When you write a text?
Right. When I write a text to somebody, not important, it's like, I am more in it, and it's harder to let go.
This is interesting. So here's what my guess is what's happening. Is that up until now, our sense of letting go is actually a little conceptual. We're trying. But when we let that go, what we begin to see is the ways that we don't let go. So this is beginning to, this is called insight. This is beginning to see our pattern. It's only at the moment of enlightenment that we really let go of everything. So to become more sensitive to when we're holding on, this is the path, actually. This is the path and this is the practice. Because when we begin to let go, there's nothing to do. That's the definition of letting go. So to become, and we mentioned this earlier today, when we become more sensitive to the various ways that we're grasping, this is the practice. This is insight. So Harriet, so this is good news.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we can ask ourselves, well, with as many years as I've been practicing, as good as my life is, and as how wonderful it is, what it must be like for other people to let go who have really hard situations, who have never encountered such a thing as training the mind. And that develops compassion. Mm-hmm. If this is as hard for me as it is for others, what it must be like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, Steve.
Hey, Tim. So this is about seeing or meeting the guru of the phenomenal world. The other day I was confronted by someone who was extremely angry at nothing in particular that I had done, but was in front of me as anger and almost hatred. And it was such a shock. I felt at that point that I had never met anyone that angry. And what occurred to me then somewhat, and certainly now after this conversation, is that the shock is seeing not the anger, but the suffering. It just totally became clear what the samsara effect, what the karmic patterning was all about. And it became sort of, for me, a lesson in my own stuff, right? So we have these opportunities where it looks like something of an emotion, certainly of someone's afflictive emotion, and it becomes a learning opportunity.
Fantastic. This is the path. This is wonderful. This is good news. They become your teachers. And then we can actually get off other people's back, worry about ourselves and not other people so much. Okay, so I need to get off in just 1 second. So let's just take a minute to imagine that if something helpful and wholesome and beneficial happened in this last hour, let's just, in our mind, offer it up to beings who need it so badly. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. Let's unmute and say goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.